Okay, we're just coming up on 7:30, so I'll go ahead and do my spiel. So welcome all to the Ottawa PC Group Q&A session. As always, we welcome guests at any time, any of our meetings. If you want to join, I've pasted it into the chat where you can go, or just go to our homepage and click on the Join or Renew link at the top, and that'll take you through the process. And if you haven't, if you wanted to join and you haven't done so, you missed out on our special. So up until the end of March, we had a 2-for-1. So that is gone now. But as I say, continue to join as a guest if you so desire. Later on this evening, courtesy of Alan's hard work, the contents of the deck in PDF format, the audio track and the chat contents will go up on our website for your ability to review the material. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, so we have a somewhat different Q&A tonight. Nobody sent anything in, and Chris and I didn't produce anything, so we hope everybody enjoyed Q&A. Next week will be a regular meeting, so the next Q&A will be on April the 15th. So we'll see you then. But of course, you do know what today is, right? Okay, so we do have a few things lined up after all. Some questions came in, and the first one was from Natalie, who's in the process of changing to a new smartphone, and does anyone know how you can back everything up off the old phone before she makes the change to the new phone? And she mentioned Samsung Smart Switch and similar software that will move things from the old phone to the new phone. But she's concerned that it might not work perfectly. So if anybody has used Samsung Smart Switch and knows all about that stuff, and Natalie would be happy to hear from you. So put something in the chat or send us an email and we'll follow up next time. And in the meantime, Chris has the next question.
Yeah, so this was another one that came in by email. And so the person was trying to reach company through an email link and tried multiple times and could not get a response from any of the emails. Couldn't find any way to reach them by phone. And so this person is wondering, is the issue just at their end, lack of customer service? And so they just refused to answer their emails and don't care to talk to anybody on the phone? Or is it potentially something on their end of the email with Gmail? And so some of the things that were tried, and my clicks are not working here. So some of the things that were checked in the spam and trash folders just in case they actually did respond and it ended up there. And then also check just to be sure in the filters and blocked email addresses that they weren't blocking any inbound emails. And so a person was wondering, is there anything else that could be the cause on their end that maybe they could address it? And so I didn't have any ideas beyond what has already been tried. If anybody else has some other ideas of things that they could try, you could unmute yourself right now. Or if you think about it during the meeting, throw it into the chat, and we can pass that on to the requester.
You can always ask an AI to take a look for emails for a corporation. They've done a pretty good job of it. They can do a pretty good job of it. I use Perplexity, but I'd imagine there are others that also do searches.
Yeah, it could also look for phone numbers, I guess, too. So if they have something that isn't published anymore, or maybe was published in the past, they might be able to find that through an AI. That's a good idea.
Bob says that she finds that contacting companies through Facebook works.
That's interesting. Yeah, there could be something other than just through their regular means on their website. Good ideas.
Okay, all right, so we had a couple of questions in the chat last week, and one of them was from Richard, and he said, can anyone recommend a shell script that can be run on shared machines to automatically preserve downloaded data and login details to a data key, a USB key, I guess, or a cloud account, cloud storage. So I'm sure if you search around, there's millions of pieces of open source software out there. The trick is, of course, to find it. But one thing that I thought was if you find the shell script that kind of does what you want, you're almost certainly going to have to edit it and tailor the actual content to your specific situation. So maybe you might as well build your own script to start with. So this is another case where Vibe Coding might help you. So, and if you remember Vibe Coding, you tell the chatbot what it is you want to do, and then it does some code, it creates some code. In this case, it would create a script file. You run the script, and if it doesn't do what you want, then you go back and you revise the prompt, and you go around that circle until the chatbot develops a script that will do exactly what you want for you. So, I wasn't quite sure what Richard meant by downloaded data. I imagine data files which have been downloaded, and also login details, and then to a cloud account. So I'm not sure whether that's he wants to save the login details and transfer those to the cloud account, or you need the login to access the cloud account. Anyway, I just gave ChatGPT exactly what he asked for, basically. He said, can you write a shell script that will do what Richard wanted? And it said, oh, I can't possibly do that, or rather, I can't possibly do that with passwords because they're private and confidential and might be security risks and I might get locked up in jail or something. But it can help with backing up data files to a USB key or a cloud account. And so it's going to create a script and it's going to use a USB drive or a cloud account. And you notice it's going to use Archon. So when I look at the scripts, again, this is me asking the question, and the chatbot knows it's me, and it knows I'm interested in Linux and bash scripts. So it's actually suggesting a bash script, or two bash scripts. One uses rsync to do the data files to the key, and the other one's going to use rclone to go up to the account. So again, you have to give it a lot more information in order to get the type of script that you want. If you want a Windows script, then you better tell the bot that you're running Windows. So here's what it's given me a couple of options. Firstly, to back up to a USB data key, and then it needs a USB drive to be mounted, and it's got the mount point there. And then the second one is to back up to a cloud account using this rclone utility. And again, it'll be in a bash script. So it talks about why it doesn't want to deal with the login details and you know, that it's not safe. And then finally, it says, if your real goal is, and then all these different options, tell me what you want me to do, and I'll design a secure solution tailored to that use. So again, give it more information and very specific details of what you want, and it will generally produce a good result. I'm just going to concentrate on the script that does the backup to a USB key, because that's easy. I just plug in a USB key and I can try it, whereas I don't have to mess around with a cloud account and, you know, giving all kinds of login credentials to get things working properly. So here is my downloads folder on my Linux box. And you can see they're mainly utility programs and applications. LibreOffice there, for example, the Zoom utility, the client. ULD is a package of printer drivers, printer scanner drivers. Veracrypt is a secure storage option, encrypted storage. And Free File Sync is the file and folder synchronization utility. So those are the files I download to install that software on my system. So here's the bash script that this is ChatGPT, I think, created for me. And you notice where I've highlighted in red that it says change this to match your USB mount point. So I had to change the kind of generic USB descriptor to my actual USB 8 gigabyte name for my USB drive. And by the same token, and it didn't tell me to, but if you look at the user home tag right at the top there, I have to tell it that it's my home directory and my user ID is actually Toaster. So those two things tailor this bash script to my purposes. So I run the bash. Remember, by coding, you just take the script, you copy it into a file. In this case, it's a backupdownloads.sh. It's a shell script. You copy it into that file, and then you just run the file. So I'm running it here under bash command and telling you which file I want. And it says, oops, I don't understand /r/r/r. And I was kind of surprised about this because I wasn't quite sure what the problem was. So again, it's bad coding, right? So what you do is you take the whole of this text message, copy and paste into the clipboard, and then copy it into ChatGPT, and it says, well, this error means that /r means that you saved the script. It was a Windows script, and it had control line feed endings on the end of every line, but Linux only wants a line feed. So the extra character, the script couldn't understand what was going on, so it basically crashed. However, it tells me it's easy to fix. You use the sed command, and there's the sed command, so I can just get rid of these R's by doing some kind of replace here in the file. So if I go back into my terminal, and I copy and paste that sed command, run that, nothing shows because it just does it silently, and then I run the same bash command to run the script file. And this time it starts telling me, well, I'm copying various files, and here's the bottom one is a progress report. It's done 32,000 bytes, and it's got 4.5 minutes to go, sort of thing. But eventually everything will get copied, and it will tell me down here that the backup is complete. So now I can go to my USB drive, and here's my second surprise. Here's my USB drive with no files. My download files aren't there. So I thought about that for a second, and I decided to have a little look inside the system volume information folder. Oops, and inside that folder is a subfolder, which is the backup with the date. And inside that folder, inside the backup folder, there are my downloaded files. So the script did actually do what it said, it's just it did it slightly differently than I was expecting, I guess. But that's bad coding for you. So let's have a look at the script. So here's the script, and the bottom thing right here I recognize as being the rsync command. And if I pull that up, and rsync is the file synchronization utility. It's running it in archive mode, which just saves all the file attributes, whatever they are. It does it in verbose mode, so it lists the files as it goes along. The progress gives me that number of bytes, the percentage finished, the time remaining, that sort of stuff. And then I have to tell it what the source folder is and what the destination folder is. So that whole line basically says, copy all this stuff from the source to the target, to the destination. And here's the line that I wasn't expecting. The USB target command, it's obviously pointing to some kind of USB base address, and then it's doing all kinds of min depths and max depths and all kinds of stuff which I've never seen. So it actually, I'll cheat here. It actually tells me, it put a comment here and it says find the first mounted USB directory, right? But I didn't know that command, so I gave that to ChatGPT, and I said, which folder on the USB drive is located using this command. And it says it's the first directory one level inside the base, inside the root, in other words. So it looks inside the root. It finds a folder. That folder was system volume information, if you remember. And so it created the backup folder inside that first folder. So if that's not what you wanted to do, then you would go back to the prompt and say, and don't search for the first folder, first directory. Just use the root of the USB drive and create the folder there. I didn't bother doing that, but clearly you could do that if you want. So there's a quick example of how you could create a script to do the transfer of the downloads folder to a USB drive. And I mean, that's done in Linux with a bash script, but clearly you could do it with a command prompt or a PowerShell script, whatever.
Now, Alan, before you move on, I'd just like to get your impression on whether that sort of scares me about vibe coding. I mean, it does some things that you're not expecting it to do, and it just goes and does it, especially if it's moving files around and things like that. Isn't that a little bit scary that, you know, maybe it'll destroy things?
Yeah, I guess it is. That's why we have backups.
Okay. We'll leave it at that then. Okay, I don't see anything in the chat.
Okay, next one is yours.
Okay. So I have, I'm having troubles with advancing slides. There we go. Now we jump down to. Okay, so I've talked before about getting Windows performance metrics, and I'm going to talk about one tool in particular, but just as a little bit of an intro to it for anybody who's not really familiar with the idea of performance metrics in Windows. If you're working on your Windows computer and things are getting really, really slow, it usually is something that you can actually track down and maybe be able to address. So what it often is that one or more resources are being depleted. So either you're running out of memory or CPU usage is going up to 95% or above, or you have a huge amount of disk activity going on. Something like that is what's bogging it down. Well, Windows actually does include some tools and some metrics that are exposed that can actually help you out trying to determine what it is. So they provide Task Manager is their primary tool. So in Task Manager, you can press Control-Shift-Escape, we'll load it, or if you right-click empty space on the taskbar, you can choose Task Manager from the pop-up that comes up. And then you'll get a window that looks similar to this, and you have columns for each of the metrics that Windows is tracking. You can sort by any one of those columns by just clicking on the header. And so clicking on the CPU, I can see that my overall CPU utilization is 13%. So I'm not running out of resources in it, so I don't have a problem there. But if I look at memory, memory might actually be a problem. Right now I'm using 80% of my memory, and I have one program in particular, Amon Photo Raw, which is using 8 gigabytes of RAM. So, you know, I can use that sort of information to say, okay, let me track this down. What is causing the problem? Then what can I do about it? Maybe in this case, I would just stop using Amon Photo Raw if I'm doing other things, and that would free up all kinds of RAM for other programs, that sort of idea. So the visibility of this is a bit of a pain, I find, using Task Manager. So the scenario is you feel that things are sluggish, then you have to actually go and load Task Manager to see if there's resource depletion that you can actually address. What if you could actually see the resource usage at a glance without loading Task Manager? That would be a lot handier. So last week, I talked about App Control, which is a quite nice resource monitor that you can have always visible on the taskbar. So here's a depiction of it, how it appears on my computer. And so it's just right to the right of the chevron that brings up hidden icons in the system tray. And it shows CPU and memory utilization all the time. So if I'm noticing things that are getting slow, I can just glance down at that and see if I got a problem there, then I might go to Task Manager and try to track down exactly what it is that's causing the problem. So this week I'm going to talk about a new Microsoft Power Toy Command Palette Dock. Now, Command Palette is not new. It's been around for a long time. Command Palette Dock is a new thing where you can actually have the Command Palette, rather than you call it up and it just appears in the middle of the screen, you can actually have it dock and always be available, always visible, either at the top, bottom, left, or the right side of the screen. And by default, it will include Performance Monitor as one of the Command Palette extensions that'll be there. And so this is the way it would look if it's docked to either the top or the bottom of the screen, where you'll see a number of metrics that are exposed there, and you can see all the time because nothing overlays them. If you have it on the left or right of the screen, it'll look something like that. So some of the advantages of using Command Palette Dock, it's already installed if you use Microsoft PowerToys, and who wouldn't want to use Microsoft PowerToys? So it's already installed, you just have to turn it on. It can be docked anywhere on your screen, on the sides of the screen or the top or the bottom, so your choice on that. There are all kinds of other extensions that can be pinned to Command Palette Dock. So things like currency conversion, unit conversion, you know, there's all kinds of them that are available that you can add to Command Palette to have at a single click a whole bunch of other functionality. Now, besides giving me the resource information like that, I can have things like currency converter. So if I want, all I have to do is click on currency converter, type in a dollar figure, and I have it set so it'll automatically give me that value in Canadian dollars, what is that in US dollars, euros, and British pounds. And it'll also give me, if I put in that particular value in Canadian dollars, in US dollars, what is it in Canadian dollars? Or if that was in euros, what is it in Canadian dollars? Or in British pounds, what is it in Canadian dollars? I find that really, really handy if you're doing international shopping and things like that, to be able to extremely quickly come up with a currency conversion on that and know what it's really going to cost you. I believe they update automatically from some source once a day. I also have a calculator on there. I also have change case, where if I accidentally hold down the caps lock key and I type in a whole bunch of stuff and it's in the wrong case, I can click on there and I can fix it in a couple of clicks. You know, so I find that it's handy to use the Command Palette, and the dock now allows me to have these tools at a fingertip away. So some of the disadvantages, it uses quite a bit of real estate if you only use it for resource monitoring. So I have a 4K monitor, and you know, the resource monitor portion of it is probably about 20% of the width of it, and the rest of that bar that is going across the screen would just be wasted real estate. So if all you use it for is a resource monitoring, maybe it's not the best thing to do. It's not very configurable. You get all of the resources or none of them. So I don't particularly care about the resource monitoring on uploads, downloads, and GPU utilization. So it'd be nice if I could turn those off. I can't. So I do give a two-hour presentation mostly through the Ottawa Public Library on Windows Performance Tune-Up, and I cover this resource monitoring as well as a whole bunch of things that can help you out if you're having problems with performance in Windows. Right now, we don't have anything scheduled currently through the end of June, so it'd be at least September before we have them again. The library branches request what presentations they want. We don't impose presentations on them. So if you want that one at your friendly neighborhood library, talk to the librarians there and suggest that they might want to have me come in September. And that's all I have for that.
Question, Chris. Is this a new PowerToy? And if so, presumably you have to update PowerToys to access it.
Yeah, it's the Command Palette is not new, and so you always had that capability, but you had to activate a hotkey to actually get to Command Palette, and then you could actually say, oh, okay, I want resource monitoring. The ability to dock it on the screen, that's new. And so you would have to be on something that has been released within the last about 3 weeks, I guess, that they first released the one with Command Palette dock.
Okay, Tim notes that another way to get to Task Manager is to use Control-Alt-Delete.
Yep, you can also just hit the start button and type in task manager. There's quite a few ways of getting to it. I used to use right click on the taskbar and choose task manager from the pop-up. Now I'm in the habit of, if I want it, just control shift escape is the fastest way. And there's an advantage to doing that as well that I outlined in a newsletter article, where it actually loads in the context of the system. And even if you're having real severe difficulties with your system, it's more likely to be able to load through control shift escape rather than any other means of loading it.
And Tom notes that SysInternals Process Explorer can give you information, control, and history. And you can also show taskbar mini graphs to show congestion.
Yep.
And Natalie wants to know, can you choose which resource is used for the dot, e.g. for the currency rate?
For currency conversion, that one, I don't think you have any control over what gets used. There are two currency conversion extensions. I don't know if they use the same source or not. I just figure for my usage, anything is probably going to be really close, considering that they update once a day. Whatever source they use, it's going to be close enough for my purposes.
Okay, all right. Thanks very much, Chris. That's everything in the chat, I think.
Great.
So the second question that came into the chat last week was, can we talk more about GitHub? I think this was Karen, says she hears lots of people talk about it, but she doesn't really know what GitHub is. So it turns out that if you want to know about GitHub, you also have to know about Git. And you've probably heard about Git, and you may or may not know what it does. Git is basically a software version control system. And it was developed by Linus Torvalds, the initial developer of Linux, in April of 2005. And he was upset with the version control systems that were available. One of them, I think it went proprietary or something, and he wanted something that was fast and open source, so he decided he would just build one himself. Clearly, they're using it for Linux, so it's really intended for software development is its primary purpose, and basically by large teams of programmers. When you've got lots of different people generating code on all kinds of different aspects of a big software project, somehow you have to manage the process. And so this Git is a version control system that does that. So that he's trying to manage all these programmers who are doing source code on. And it's not just Linux. It's applicable to any software development project, and for other things as well. In fact, one of the neat things is that it's what's termed a distributed system. So all of these programmers, each software developer, they have a full copy of the whole system, and it's stored in a repository, which is a fancy name for a folder. Or multiple folders, and everybody who's playing with Git has a copy of this repository. So that's neat, because it means if one thing goes down, then it's still available all over the place. So you can, it's like instant backup, if you like. The big thing about it is that when you make changes to your files, then you commit them, and that basically stores a copy of the system as it is at that moment. And so all these people are developing software and committing changes, and Linus, or whoever's the master controller, he is looking at these changes and then merging them into the main stream software. So that's how it's kind of working on an individual level. But GitHub is essentially an online repository. So everybody who's doing this distributed processing stuff is using the same online repository. So a website somewhere, a web server somewhere that's storing all these files. And that's where the master copy is. And that's where people are, committing their changes and where they've been reviewed and where they've been merged, and new versions of the software are then created. So on a local perspective, you think about, you know, a programmer working on a local computer somewhere. He's installed Git on his computer, so he has a whole bunch of commands. And the kind of simple ones that we'll talk about here, he installs Git on his computer, and then he does a git init command. So he initializes a local repository on his computer, and that shows up, or it doesn't show up, because it's a hidden folder. It's a .git folder on the computer, so it's not normally visible. So now he's writing code, and he's got a bunch of files, and he can decide that he wants to add these files for inclusion in a future commit. So he doesn't have to do all the files. Can do if he does a git add period, that in that commit that adds everything to what they call the staging area. But he can select certain files to commit to add to the staging area. And then once he's happy that he's got all the files added that he wants, he does a git commit minus M, and then he adds some text. This is a change where I included a for loop to go to the user database. Right, so now he's got his commit as a snapshot of his system at that moment in time, and he's got a message, a tag if you like, which tells him what stage the process he was at when he made that particular commit. And then you can use all kinds of other commands like git status, git diff, and git log, and that looks at the progress report, if you like, and tracks the changes, see what the differences are from one version to the other, that kind of thing. So that's the kind of management process on an individual basis. And the neat thing about Git is, remember, you're doing this as kind of a, as you're developing, as a work in progress, you're making these commits at various stages and adding these messages to tell you what the commit is. If you really make a mistake, then you're allowed to go back. And to do that, you use a git checkout, and there's a hash string which identifies whatever version you want to go back to. And that basically pulls in that old snapshot into your working area. And so now you've reverted to your previous commit. The other neat thing about Git is that you can develop your program or whatever it is you're working on in a kind of a line, if you like, a line of commits as you go down the branch. But then you decide, oh, wouldn't it be nice if I could develop a feature that would do X, Y, and Z? But I'd rather kind of play with that separately from my main system, which I know is working. So you're allowed to branch and create a second branch away from the master. Now you've got this development branch or feature branch, whatever you want to call it, and you can develop this feature, and then if it works, then you merge it into the parallel, into the master branch, and if it doesn't work, you just abandon it and you go back to the main branch and continue with the software that is working. In terms of the distributed version, so now we're thinking of some kind of project where all these people are working. All the individuals are using Git locally, like I just described. But now they have to do a Git config, because when they commit their software, the people who are using it want to know who did it and how to get in touch with them. So Git config basically identifies the user with a username and an email address. He can still use git add and commits for the local work stream, and he's going along his own little branch there. And then when he's finished his feature or whatever he's developing, then he can push that. He does a git push to transfer his local commit to the main work stream for review and merging, hopefully, into the process. So now here's where the manager comes in, the benevolent dictator in Linux terms, Linus Torvalds. He's in charge of final reviews and final mergers into the new version of Linux, for example. The other command that the local users can use is git pull, where he can pull out, he can obtain a new copy of the online repository from GitHub onto his local machine and then carry on from there. And that distributed system again means there are multiple copies of everything, so no single point of failure. Now, Git is really used for software development, but there's no reason you can't use it for any kind of project, especially when you're dealing with computer files. And what you're doing is you're keeping track of multiple versions or progress or whatever you want to call it. And so, for example, Chris and I are in the process of writing a newsletter article, and it's going to be all about Linux distros. And I've written the introduction, and I've decided I'm going to do the easy bit. I'm going to develop the section which is on Debian-based distros, because that's like Ubuntu and Mint and all the things I know about. But Chris, who, you know, everybody knows Chris is a huge fan of Linux, he's going to do the hard bit, and he's going to look at Arch-based distros, which are cutting-edge Arch and Catchy OS and those kind of things. He's going to develop that section, and then eventually we'll merge the two together, and I'll write a final paragraph which has got some conclusions. Now, Chris didn't seem to take to that altogether. He doesn't seem to think that he's quite the Linux fan that I think he is, so seems to think it's got something to do with today's data, and I can't understand that. Anyway, if you haven't understood a word I've said, a picture is worth 1,000 words, and I'm sure I haven't used 1,000 words, but here's what I mean by a master branch, a main branch, and a feature branch. So the main branch is the development of the article as far as I'm concerned. I write the introduction. I write a paragraph about Debian. I write a paragraph about Ubuntu, and then one about Mint. And in parallel, Chris has gone off and developing this branch on Arch-based systems, and he's talking about Arch and CatchyOS and EndeavorOS. And then once he's finished that, he'll push those to the master branch. I will merge them into the article, write the conclusions, do the final review, and then send it off to Bridget. So that's kind of another example of how you would use Git for a multi-author publication, for example. Now, the other thing that GitHub does, is, as well as serving as this software management process, when a developer has produced a software package, he can use GitHub to actually distribute it to the world. And a case in example Chris mentioned earlier, they're PowerToys. If you want PowerToys, then what you do is you download it from GitHub. And there's all kinds of, I mean, there are thousands of projects on GitHub, open source projects, with all kinds of things that you could use, maybe. PowerToys being one of them. So again, if you're interested in what I talked about, if you didn't understand what I talked about, a couple of the YouTube videos which explain it much better. Colt Steele here, Learn Git in 15 Minutes, an example of a HTML project which he's developing. And then Kevin Stratbert talks about Git. He has a cookie company which he's writing a website for. And then he also talks about how that works in with GitHub. So if you want to know about Git and GitHub, that's a really good video, a bit longer. But he explains it really well. Okay, that's all I have on Git and GitHub.
We have a couple of comments in the chat about Git. And we have one question from Harvey. Does the Git checkout prevent access to that software until the developer commits the changes.
Git checkout basically moves you back down the branch to a previous version.
So it would be more
that would, a previous version would be a previous commit. So it would have been committed, and then you check out back to it.
Okay. Okay, that's the only question I think we had in there.
Okay, so next up is you and a keyboard shortcut.
Yes, we're up to number 7. So again, keep your hands on the keyboard, and you don't have to reach for the mouse to get things doing. So say you wanted to select text from wherever your current cursor position is to somewhere else. Well, we always, probably most of us know, that if you hold down the shift key, and you can use the arrow key either left or right, and that'll select character by character. But if you want to select a little bit more, you can do the selecting of the previous word by control shift and left arrow, or the next word, control shift and the right arrow. Or you can do the previous paragraph by doing control shift and the up arrow, or the next paragraph, control shift down arrow. And if you want to get right to the start of the document, if you hold down control shift home, it'll select from your current position to the start of the document. Or if you hold down the shift key, it'll do control shift end, it'll select all of the text from your current cursor position to the end of the document. That's it.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Okay, so the final thing we have prepared is part 2 of the disk image backup and recovery. Last time we talked about how to make a full disk backup image. So this time we're going to see how to recover it. And eSys to do backup actually calls it restore. So we're going to try and restore a full disk image backup. So one of the things we can do is you can hit this browse to recover link right here. Alternatively, once we set up our batch jobs, we can right click on the batch job that we use to create the backup image of disk zero, that's my hard drive. I can right click on that, and then I can access recover from the drop down menu. So whatever way suits you best. Once you do that, then you're in disk and partition mode. You use this drop down here to find the image that you want, and we're going to try and recover all of the partitions on this hard drive. And if we keep doing that, if we follow that restore wizard, we'll go down the rabbit hole, and eventually this will kick in, and it will say the target partition is occupied and can't be deleted. Please do something else. So the issue here is that what we're trying to do is restore the Windows partition as part of that full disk image. We're trying to recover the whole drive and in part of that, the Windows partition on a system that's running Windows. Well, Windows doesn't like that. It won't let you overwrite itself when it's a running system. So you can't do that. But the clue is right here. You can reboot into WinPE to continue. So one of the things when you install eSys to do and start using it, it will pop up this box. It's recommended to create an emergency disk now so that you can do the recovery easier when you need to do it. So this is our problem. We can't recover a Windows partition from a running Windows system, but if we use a live USB, then that will be okay. So we have to create a recovery disk. So from the main menu, we need to go to Tools, and when we hit Tools, we'll get this Create an Emergency Disk option. We can run that utility, and what we need to do is select this little USB icon here. We want to create a rescue disk on a USB, and then we need to scroll down, drop down the menu here, and choose the USB drive that we want to create as a live USB. So I'm going to use this drive E. And now it tells me that WinPE, the pre-environment version, doesn't support clone and system transfer. I actually don't care about that because I'm only interested in backing up and restoring partitions, and the rescue disk does support those. So I'm happy just to say create now. And so off it goes, and we've got this progress bar, and it says it's going to take about a minute, and that's good. But then all of a sudden it stops and says, oops, now you need to format your USB drive. Sure, because we're going to wipe out your USB drive. If there's anything on it, we're going to overwrite it. So make sure that you're using a USB drive that's either empty or one that you don't have anything that you want to keep. And then eventually it will create the ISO file, it will export it to the USB drive, and once it's successfully exported, it's done. And it took, in my case, it took about 7 minutes. So now we finish, we've got the, so here's our USB drive. However, it looks suspiciously empty. It says, this folder is empty. Now, the first time I ran this, I didn't understand what was going on. I did it again, and the second disk was empty too. So then I decided to look a bit harder. It's actually not empty. If you right-click on the USB here, right-click on this guy, and choose Properties. Didn't want to do that. Right-click on that and choose Properties, then you'll see that actually it's not empty. The use space is 613 megabytes. And if I look at it in what's this one? TreeSize 3, which is a utility which shows you all the hidden system files and folders and things, you can see that here's a 600 meg of all kinds of stuff on there, including it's an ESUS boot disk with some boot directories and that kind of stuff. So it clearly is a live USB. So now, our disk creation process did actually succeed. We can now boot the computer from the USB drive, and to do that, you need to know how to do it. So ask Mr. Google if you don't know. In my case, you hit, you power up the machine, you hit F12, and it pops up a boot menu, and then from the boot menu, you select the USB drive, and then it boots directly into ESUS to do backup, running under this pre-environment edition of Windows. So it's kind of a stripped-down version, a lightweight version of Windows, and we don't get to see Windows, it just loads directly into the application. So now we're back on the main screen, but this time we're running from the live USB. So we can say browse to recover. We're going to recover from a local drive, and the local drive is going to be my external USB drive, my passport drive. I want to go down to this ESUS folder, and the disk zero is my full disk backup images. And I've got this file here, 0620 full backup. So that's the one I want. So I'm going to say OK. And by default, it's got this guy checked. So all of these partitions are going to be restored, the whole hard drive. Now I have to tell it where I want to recover to, and it's clearly, because it's the full hard drive, it's going to restore it to the full hard drive. So it's only got the choice of the existing hard drive. And now it tells me again, here's Windows kicking in and saying, hey, you're going to overwrite the Windows partition on this hard drive. Are you sure? Well, yes, of course we're sure, because we're trying to recover this full hard drive. So we have to recover Windows as well. And then the final thing, it just gives us a summary. Here's what it looks like in the backup drive, and here's what it's going to look like on the target drive once it's finished doing it. So you notice it's kind of a one-for-one there in terms of the various partitions. So once we run it, then it will take a while. In my case, it took about an hour, but eventually it will tell you that the recovery has completed, and now you can reboot the computer from the hard drive, take the USB drive out once you've powered down the machine, and reboot the computer, and you will find that all of the disk partitions and windows, all of the factory recovery type partitions, which are hidden generally, and if you have a dedicated data partition, a Linux partition in my case, all of those things are restored because it was a full disk image backup, and so it's a full disk image restore. So you've got the operating system, Windows, most people, and all of the installed applications as they were at the time you made the backup, and all of your data files as they were when you made the backup. And so now what you might have to do is run Windows Update to update the Windows operating system to today and overwrite data files with a backup if you've got newer data files on a different backup system. So there, it's pretty easy. Just got that one little glitch where if you don't realize that you need a recovery disk to recover the system partition, then you kind of have to stop and start again once you've built your rescue disk. But it's pretty easy to create a backup and restore a backup. Okay, Charleston says, can the emergency be made on a DVD and should we? Yeah, there's no reason why not. DVD just a bit slower than a live USB in terms of reading, but probably doesn't make a whole pile of difference when you're spending an hour restoring the system anyway. Yeah, I mean, I only use a live USB because I don't have a built-in optical drive anymore. It's easier just to use a USB rather than an external DVD. Okay, that's it for that.
Okay, before we go on to the wrap-up, that's the end of our prepared materials.
We've got this for the wrap, before the wrap-up.
Yeah, okay, exactly. I had one really early on from David. He said that he'd like to chime in on the item about the phone. So, David, all yours.
Okay, I had a unfortunate mishap with my old Samsung phone. I didn't need a new phone. This phone ended up in the bottom of the bathtub, and I tried the rice, I tried everything, and got nothing. So anyhow, I went out and I only had paid this one off like a month earlier. So it was basically free. My account, my Virgin Mobile account, would have been $10 cheaper. So anyhow, I had to get a new phone. So I went out and bought another Samsung. So the old was an old Samsung. This is a Samsung S25. And he takes it out of the box and he says, here, take it home and you put it on your Wi-Fi, everything will be there because the eSIM, there's no SIM card in it. And I thought, okay, this is a little bit weird. Brought it home, hooked it up to the Wi-Fi, and boom, all my email, all my contacts, everything was all there. The only thing I lost was my pictures because I had taken the SIM card out or the SD card to put my pictures on my computer and never put it back in my phone. So I lost maybe 20 pictures because I don't use iCloud. I don't use the cloud to store the pictures. I use SD card, a micro SD card. So other than those 20 pictures, that's all I lost.
Pretty impressive.
So I couldn't believe it. Yeah, so super, super neat. I said, there's no SIM. He said, no, it's the eSIM now. There's no SIMs in any of the new phones.
Well, Chris, isn't that what you did when I had the Samsung? And then I bought a Google Pixel 6, and I thought, this is going to be tricky. And it just hooked up to the Wi-Fi, and everything transferred over. We just sat there watching it.
Yeah, there was a utility that you had to load on either
side. There? Oh, okay.
And then you just basically said, this is what I want to transfer. And if you click off everything, you know, your data, your pictures, your apps, everything like that.
Right.
And if you just check them all, it'll transfer them all over. Now, I don't know if there's anything that didn't come across, but mm-hmm. I know when I did it, it seemed to be everything was there.
Yeah, and that wasn't Samsung to Samsung. It was Samsung to Google.
Yeah, to my knowledge, he didn't install anything on it because he just took it out of the box and he said, here, I'll let you pull the wrap off. So I pulled the cellophane off it, and he says, now go across this was at the mall in Oshawa, and he says, go across over there and see my buddy, because he can give me the screen protector a heck of a lot cheaper than I can. So I went across and he put the screen protector on it. He threw the case in for free. because I guess he felt sorry for me because my phone ended up in the tub. And he said, no, it's the touch display. It's not worth fixing. It's going to cost you $300 to fix a $300 phone, so it's not worth it.
So. Yeah, with Linda and I, we were going between Samsung, going from Samsung to Google Pixel phones. So when you're going cross manufacturers, I think it gets a little bit trickier. But it basically, there is the app that is included with Android that is designed to be able to do that.
Anyhow, that's all I wanted to say. But it was like it was unbelievable. I couldn't believe it.
I switched recently from a Pixel 6 to a Pixel 8 Pro. I've updated by 2 years. I find going at least between Pixels and maybe, I don't know, Androids, but basically you back up everything on the first phone, and then you, when you open the new phone, it asks you, what do you want to, what are you bringing this from a new phone and so on, and it just walks you through it, and if you use a USB cable, it goes really fast. The only thing it doesn't bring over are the settings for the programs that you use all the time, so you have to kind of redo them. But the data and the programs, so far, I haven't discovered any discrepancies between them, so that works pretty well.
Yeah.
So the software that everybody's using for this, is this on the new phone already?
I don't know. I don't, like I said, he didn't install anything on mine, but maybe it was just because it was going Samsung to Samsung. Maybe that app or whatever it is already.
I think it was just an Android app or utility, was it not, Chris?
When you
They fired up a new phone. Android app says, are you connecting to an old phone? If so, here you go. Just download everything. And
It's built in.
It's included with Android. It may have even come up automatically when you probably first did. Start up the new phone.
Yeah, probably
it
did.
Goes into that automatically and just says, okay, do you want to recover?
It was more the email and the contacts and all the phone numbers and everything. I thought, holy smokes, I don't have all those written down. So, But everything was there. And that was off the phone that wasn't even functioning.
Yeah, that's true.
I can't even turn the phone on because you can turn it on, but you can't swipe it because the display is all pixelated. Because it's the display that got ruined. So that's going from a phone that I can't even work on or work off of.
Yeah, that's another thing I was wondering about. But clearly the drive must have been okay. It was pulling stuff off the drive.
Yeah, the contents of the actual phone are still And the thing, if I charge it, I still go bleep when I get an email or when I get a text message. I just can't see anything on it.
You got to have text to voice going on it. Before we do wrap up, we do have one question I want to carry over here. Elizabeth had a question about the last part with EaseUS. Alan, when you say at the end, you reboot the computer, is that a full power down?
I don't think
it really matters.
You can do a restart. I mean, you've got to boot it out of the USB and into the main computer.
Yeah, basically it's just, you pull the USB drive that you booted from and start your computer.
Yeah, and I think what Linda was saying, I think I understand that now, because I think when you do the setup of an Android phone, it asks you that question, do you want to sync from an old device?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the software's already there for that.
Yeah.
Okay, so we are a couple of minutes, so let's carry on here. Do you have something that you'd like to share? Chris and I shared all kinds of stuff tonight. But if you've got a new phone that's super duper, any kind of new piece of hardware, or if you have an application that you find just incredible and everybody should be using it, but we don't know about it, we'd like to. Or if you just know how to do things like a keyboard shortcut, a better mousetrap. Just let us know what you're interested in and tell us how to go about it. Upcoming at the library on Saturday, April the 4th, Chris is going to be doing the ins and outs of electronic mail. So if you didn't catch that presentation a month or so ago, I guess. Chris is going to be redoing that at the main branch at 11 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. And then AI fun and useful tips at the Stittsville branch on Sunday the 12th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And if you are interested in Windows 10 end of life, it is coming up in October of this year, 2026, will be the end of support for the extended support update program. So the question is, what are you going to do then? We're back in the same boat that we were in October 2025. If there's no other extension, and I haven't heard anybody saying there's going to be any kind of extension of ESU, then again, you're back to that situation of what do you do next. And if your computer will upgrade to Windows 11, it's a no-brainer. Just do it. I mean, why wouldn't you? The problem is for people like me who I don't have any computers that will run Windows 11 in a supported basis. I mean, clearly I could install it unsupported, but not really happy about doing that. So part of this presentation is going to be, for those of us who can't use Windows 11, why don't we think about using Linux? So that's going to be part of the presentation. It's a Zoom presentation, but it's going to be run by the library. So you have to register for that if you're interested, and they will send you the link to the Zoom meeting. And we've had a lot of input from Durham in the last while, and they've invited Chris to give a presentation. So if you can't get to the libraries, then he's doing the AI fun and useful tips for the Durham Personal Computer User Group on April the 9th. And that's an open session. Anybody who wants to attend the meeting, they're willing to have you attend. And I think that's the link to the meeting right there. It must be a fixed link for all their meetings. So that's Tuesday, April the 9th at 7 p.m. Start. And then the day before that is our monthly meeting. And we've got Linda who's going to be talking about how to restore old photographs. And so we're going to be interesting to see what she can do with that one in the slide.
That's not one of my photographs.
I'm sure you're going to fix that. They'll fix that one. It'll be color, Kodachrome color, all kinds of wonderful things.
Thanks, loads.
And anybody who's wondering why I pasted in what I just pasted into the chat, I just picked up an old part of a document. Sorry.
Okay, so that's next April the 8th, next week. And because of that, there will be no Q&A next week, as usual. And just a monthly meeting, which is an hour and a half, of course. And so our next Q&A will be on April the 15th. So if you have questions or things that you'd like to share, all those things we were talking about earlier, just send us a few details to suggestion box, and we'll start up a brand new agenda for April 15th. So that's it for tonight. I think we're just a couple of minutes over our scheduled one-hour period. I hope everybody enjoyed the presentations, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. See you next week at Linda's presentation.